Welcome to the podcast. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Jung.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
Good news, everyone. We've finally come up with an official name for the podcast. China Unscripted. It's a nice name, right?
It is good, yeah.
Wild applause.
Wild applause. Leave your wild applause in the comments below. We'll read them later. Anyways, today's a special day, other than the fact that we came up with the name. We're recording this on Saturday, May 5th, which is, of course...
The 5th of May!
Cinco de Mayo, but even more importantly, the 200-year anniversary of Karl Marx's birthday.
Yay.
Yay. Well, so to celebrate, I got us all a birthday cake.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you. I'm going to divide it equally between all of us, rest assured. You guys have your ration cards?
No. Do we not get cake if we don't have ration cards?
Funny how that works. The person in charge of redistributing the cake tends to eat all of the cake.
I feel like there should be a have your cake and eat it too joke here.
Well, that only applies to me, and it's not a joke. I'm going to eat all the cake. Speaking of celebrating the birthday of Karl Marx, you have actual experience with ration cards.
Yes, when I was a child in China, there were still ration cards. They didn't get rid of them until in the early 90s. So that was fun.
It was very effective of making sure everyone had enough food, right?
Well, by the 80s, people, when I was growing up, there was enough food. But I remember my parents lived through the famine, the Great Famine, that was not at all Mao Zedong's fault. It was a completely natural disaster. My father would tell stories about how, you know, you'd get only a certain amount of meat every month, a certain amount of vegetables. And my grandmother, his mother, she just didn't know how to manage that well. So by the end of the month, they just didn't have any food they could eat besides rice and, like, not even, like, white rice, like brown rice, which I know in America now is a health food, but back then that was like, if you're really poor, you eat brown rice and coarse grain, like cornmeal kind of stuff, like you couldn't get wheat. So it was pretty rough. There was not enough food.
But thankfully you were out from under the yoke of the bourgeois oppression, right?
Actually, it didn't really work. I remember...
Communism didn't work, Shelley?
Well, my father was talking about how when they first started establishing the communes in China, and they, so you would stop feeding your own family. Everybody would go eat at the cafeteria at the commune, and they would run out of food all the time because people would just go eat. You weren't responsible for, it wasn't your food, so people would just like go eat and eat until they didn't have any food left, which made it rough for the rest of the month.
Interesting. Not the best system in the long run. So obviously, this is a history the Chinese Communist Party loves to celebrate. And so this year they've pulled out all of the stops to celebrate the bicentennial of Marx. He's the real bicentennial man, I think.
And including China gave a gift of a Karl Marx statue to a town in Western Germany.
That was a really controversial gift. That's the kind of gift of, it's like giving somebody, you know, when you give somebody else something that they have to now take care of and be responsible for.
Like a peacock?
Or I was going to say puppy.
But
puppies are cute. Karl Marx is not cute.
Well, I mean,
how hard is it to maintain a statue?
No, but even just getting the statue is a little controversial, since you remember half of Germany was also communist at one point, and people kind of suffered under that communist regime.
What are you talking about? Communism clearly works. That's why when the wall went down, all of Germany became one happy socialist utopia.
So in China, Xi Jinping has been asking officials to study Marxism. And that's interesting because, you know, if you actually read originals of Marx's writing, it's pretty different from what they're doing in China right now. Right? Like the Communist Manifesto, which I read, it's like no one is allowed to own the means of production, right? So you can't own a factory or whatever. It should all belong to collectively. But obviously China now has millions of millionaires. It's got hundreds of billionaires. All the means of production are owned privately or, of course, by like state-run industries.
Well, that's the socialism with Chinese characteristics at work.
Right. So you have the communism part of take everyone's stuff, and then the with Chinese characteristics part of redistribute it to people who are connected with the Communist Party.
Yeah, that's essentially what's happened in every communist country, isn't it?
Well, I think if you, there's always been the idea is that, you know, the proletariat is going to seize the means of production, but what actually seizes the means of production is some kind of communist party, which, you know, represents the majority of the people, so they say.
I don't know if that eye roll really translated into the audio spectrum, so I just want everyone to know that was a big eye roll from Shelley.
I'm good at eye rolls. But yeah, I think what was interesting was seeing Xi Jinping make a huge speech in front of, you know, the Politburo in the Great Hall of the People under this giant portrait of Karl Marx. You can find this photo online. It's like all of the members of the Politburo Standing Committee standing up and reciting something. I don't know what they were saying, but then behind them is Karl Marx and like a big 1818 to 2018 up right under his photo. And that's something I'm going to show anyone who tells me that China is not communist anymore.
Well, yeah. That's an interesting thing about the Chinese Communist Party's relationship with the history of communism. Because especially recently, there's been such a push of sort of this Chinese national identity and rejecting foreign influences. But fundamentally, the Communist Party is a result of foreign influence.
I have a giant portrait of a foreigner up there. Xi Jinping called Karl Marx the greatest thinker of our time.
That was 200 years ago. Is that still our time?
I was going to say it's wrong on two counts, right? Because it's not our time, but also possibly not. But I mean, you know, if you look at what the Chinese Communist Party's philosophy is, it is also very disconnected from Karl Marx.
Yes, although they seem to be able to... It doesn't seem to... How do I put this? So...
It's like they jerry-rig it in somehow.
Well, I was reading something about, there was a movie called The Young Karl Marx, which was made last year in Germany, but it had its China premiere yesterday as part of, you know, celebrating Karl Marx's birthday. And then they asked students from universities across China to go to the movie premiere and recite the Communist Manifesto, you know, in celebration of Karl Marx's 200th birthday and 40 years of Chinese economic reforms. And apparently there's no mental disconnect there.
It's called doublethink, I believe, is the term.
The reforms that, you know, went against, you know, his philosophies. We're celebrating them both at the same time.
So one of the thing sort of communist apologists always say is that, you know, if you look at a country like China, it's not real communism. And so it's not just China that's been celebrating the bicentennial of Karl Marx. In the West, there's been a lot of celebration of that as well. The New York Times ran an opinion piece that caused some controversy recently called, it was called Happy Birthday, Karl Marx, You Were Right. And I mean, technically, he was left. But thank you. We need to get a real rim shot for the sound effects.
Oh, God. Are we doing sound effects now?
Only when I make a joke. So, but there is a weird fascination with communism in the West. So Matt, you on May Day, the 1st of May, which is also actually a communist holiday, went to a demonstration?
Well, on May 1st, I went to Washington Square Park in New York, and... You know, I didn't know I was just going to the park, and they happened to have this big, it was a labor movement protest. There was a bunch of things going on, actually. So the big stage that they'd set up was about labor unions and workers' rights and a push towards socialism. And then there were different booths set up by different disconnected groups in the square. So one of them was the Communist Party of New York. There was another one that was a group, and I don't know what the name of the group was. But they had this sign, and it said, quote, defend China, Cuba, North Korea, Laos, and Vietnam against imperialism and capitalist counter-revolution, exclamation point. for workers' political revolution! Exclamation point. And they had this newspaper called The Workers' Vanguard, which they wanted me to read. And I talked to one of the people at that booth, and she basically said that people in North Korea and China are like much better off.
What?
Oh, yeah. Because
then what?
Than Americans. Because America's the worst country, she explained to me. We're the worst country.
How old was this person? I'm just curious.
She was probably mid-30s.
Oh, okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, she was a Caucasian American. And she...
Is that the technical term?
She was white. Anyway, she was American. She...
So how is she justifying that people in North Korea are better off than Americans?
Well, I asked her, and she said, well, they're not under the thumb of U.S. imperialism, but the U.S. needs to back off. And I said, well, what about the prison camps in North Korea where if you commit a political crime, not only do they sentence you, but also members of your family? And she says, well, that's not true. That's American imperialist propaganda that's slandering North Korea.
And did you ask her what was so great about North Korea other than the fact that they're not American imperialists?
Yeah, she said, well, it's a great country. I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? She's like, well, I'm like, what about the regime? You support the Kim Jong-un government? She's like, well, I support the country.
What?
I know. Well, you're wondering what that means. And I also wondered what that means. But she didn't have a great explanation for it. But it was just interesting because, you know, she really genuinely seemed to believe that China and North Korea and, you know, Vietnam, Laos were inherently better societies than America, which was the worst. This American woman was basically saying America's the worst country.
But I was just wondering what her argument was.
I think you heard essentially what her argument was.
Well, her argument was that we don't know how good things are there because
we're being lied to constantly
by our own government and our media.
I mean, that's basically like saying, like, everything you've ever heard about ISIS is totally wrong. They're this great humanitarian group, and everything you've heard from the lying imperialist media is lies.
Right, or it's like saying everything that NASA has said about the Earth.
Look, Matt, the Earth is flat. We're not getting into this again.
But anyway, and then I talked, there's another booth unconnected, was the Communist Party of New York. And again, they're here at this, like, May Day rally to support labor movements.
Mayday, mayday. Yeah, mayday. We're going down.
But this guy was very articulate, actually.
More articulate than the other one.
Yes. And I asked him, you know, I told him that, you know, I do, you know, work regarding human rights in China. And he kind of dismissed that the human rights were really that bad here.
Here? You mean?
In China.
Okay.
Compared to the U.S., which, you know, he says, well, you have more people per capita in jail in the U.S. than in China.
Nice.
It's technically true
if you look at the official Chinese statistics versus the official U.S. statistics. I believe the U.S. statistics are essentially accurate, whereas the Chinese statistics are intentionally misleading and false.
If you talk about prisons, you're not going to count labor camps, black jails, re-education camps like the ones they've set up in Xinjiang. So none of that is a prison.
Right.
Ah, I see.
So essentially, yeah. So that's just a way that they're skewing the data. So for one, he believed that's a problem, that the U.S. is much worse than any other country. But also, I asked him, well, you know, in the U.S., like, you know, if we work hard, we can get stuff and we can have material wealth. And he's basically saying that it's unfair for anyone to have material wealth because it's always on the backs of other people. I was like, well, what if you're a farmer? You know, you're living off the earth. And he's like, well, where did you get that land? Your ancestors must have stolen it from someone.
It's like, which, okay.
But they're dead. Like it's not, this, like, you can't hold people responsible for things that they're direct or indirect ancestors may or may not have done.
Well, okay, let's say that everybody's guilty. What's the solution?
Right. So, yeah, his philosophy was that everyone is guilty, and they're by having material things, they are guilty of having gotten them on the backs of others. And the solution is to take their stuff.
Who's going to take their stuff?
The people.
Wait, aren't the people guilty then as well?
No, the other people, the people who aren't guilty.
Oh, the people. Who are the unguilty people?
The people who are not the guilty ones. Oh, so okay. The guilty ones are people who have stuff.
Am I a guilty one?
Do you have you have a TV?
I only have Revolutionary Fever.
Okay, then you're probably okay. But someone like me who owns, for example, a TV and a laptop, I would be guilty and I should redistribute that laptop among the masses.
Well, I don't think that's what he was saying.
Yeah, but he was basically saying that it's morally right and justified to take people's stuff, even if they acquired it legitimately through the current legal system. Like, I legally acquired my laptop by buying it from Apple. But he thinks that I'm guilty of having the means to be able to do this in the first place. Therefore, it's justified to take my stuff and redistribute it. And if I resist, I should be stopped by force.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Well, did you try and take his pants?
I was actually thinking of saying, well, give me your shoes. But
You should have gone for the
pants. I should have gone for the pants.
I'm curious, what was the ethnicity of this fellow?
He actually looked a lot like me.
Really?
Yeah.
So a cisgendered white male is talking about oppression. I don't think that flies.
Yeah. But it was. I think overall it was an interesting experience just to see. You know, I like talking with people who have views I don't agree with, because it's interesting for me to kind of hear where they're coming from and try to understand their side of the argument. You know, I'll come out of it maybe believing some of it or agreeing some of it, or in this case, not agreeing with it. But it's just interesting to kind of hear where he's coming from, and you see the logic. But in many ways, it's a very twisted logic that justifies violence against people for crimes that they didn't commit.
Well, it's violence in the goal of this utopian society. And so anyone who is part of this oppressive class, you know, you're justified in doing anything to them to liberate the oppressed and create a utopia. Isn't that
what I find interesting about these arguments is that it always gets a little vague when they start talking about who is going to seize the means of who is going to take the stuff from people.
Has that ever historically been a problem with communism?
Well, they've always found someone to take the stuff away.
That's true. There's always been stuff and people to take from.
But the thing is that you won't hear these arguments. By and large, you will not hear these arguments from people who have actually lived under communism.
Which is why it's so strange to see in the New York Times an opinion piece saying Marx was right.
It's not really strange. The New York Times opinion section, they publish a lot of controversial things that they kind of defend as saying, this is going to spark a conversation. But a lot of times, it doesn't really spark a very,
uplifting?
No, not uplifting. Constructive conversation. I'm not talking about whether it's uplifting or not. It's just there to make people angry. And they publish one a day later about how, you know, maybe sex robots should be used to solve, you know, the problem of people who don't have enough sex and therefore get angry about it.
All right, now I'm very interested in this.
Well, my point is that the New York Times opinion section publishing something about Marx being right is not an indication, I think, of the broader American...
It's not the pulse of America.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's...
Because last year they had a series of pieces for the 100-year anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, which is how the Soviet Union got started. And some of those pieces, you know, they had titles like How Mao Molded Communism to Create a New China, or The Cold War and America's Delusions of Victory. And my favorite was Women Had Better Sex Under Socialism, which was the first time I've heard that argument.
But there were actually also a lot of op-eds that were condemning communism.
That's true. There was one in the Wall Street Journal.
In the New York Times, too, part of their series.
Oh, that's good to get both sides. But I think you actually touch on a very interesting point about the comment sections for these, how it just made people angry. And that reminds me of an article you read recently in New York Magazine, where somebody who works for Microsoft and is a pioneer in the field of virtual reality was talking about this term he coined, digital Maoism. Would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so it was this really interesting article from back in April from New York Magazine. There's a section called Select All that's about digital things, and this reporter, Noah Cohen, interviewed, I'm going to say his name is Jaron Lanier. I don't know if that's the right pronunciation, but he works for Microsoft now, but he was a VR pioneer, and he had talked about the topic of this conversation was what went wrong with the internet, and he was talking about this term that he had made up a few years ago called digital Maoism. And what he was talking about is kind of like, even though it seems like the internet is doing something very democratic and that everybody can participate in making something like Wikipedia, in the end, it kind of all becomes one almost hive mind in a way, that you're contributing to like one correct way, one correct truth that's reflected in Wikipedia, or the kind of rise of online mob mentalities where, you know, people just get angry about things. And then there are things that appear to be using social media to do something positive, like the Me Too movement or, you know, Black Lives Matter. And then what it actually causes is like a negative backlash that becomes even greater than what the original kind of social movement was supposed to do.
So the internet is making us all angrier, more unhappy people.
Yeah, and it was really interesting because this digital Maoism thing he was talking about was about how, you know, it seems like, so on the surface, everybody's being empowered, but what's actually happening is the very small group of people are actually consolidating power. And you could say that in the digital world is like Facebook or these large, you know, tech companies. And then he compared it to communism and how, you know, it seems like the people are seizing power, but ultimately it's always like a communist party that's mm-hmm. seizing power, like this large organization that's actually seizing the power. And it's happening in the internet in China, but he said he thinks it's also because the state is definitely very visibly taking control of the internet there, but he was talking about how he thinks it's happening on the rest of the internet as well.
You know, for our listeners who aren't so familiar with how things worked under Maoism, one of the things that Mao was really good at, and he did this a lot, is getting different groups of society to go up against other groups. Like, and this is part of the Marxist idea of, you know, the history of the world is the history of class struggle. And so what Mao would do is take, you know, a group that was maybe like 5% or no more than 10% of the population, and he'd give them a label like the rightist group or the intellectuals or the counter-revolutionaries. Yeah, landlord class, right? And so then he would get the rest of the country to rise up and struggle against them. And essentially, struggle could mean anything from public humiliation to arrest to murder. And this mob mentality, I think, is kind of what Lanier was talking about here, that the internet, even in a free democratic society, can kind of end up having this mob mentality that then goes after a group. And unfortunately, the openness of the internet is not able to be perfectly democratic because it's controlled by these companies. Like if you look at Facebook, how they, you know, they tend to feed you articles and posts that their algorithms and their AI bots believe that you will read and keep you engaged. And one of the things that makes you engaged is when things make you angry and they make you interact with things.
Yeah,
and
negative emotions definitely much more powerful.
Yeah, so like essentially these large companies like Facebook are manipulating us to keep us engaged on their platform.
But that's not the way they see it. They are like, we're making the world a more connected place.
And they're doing that too. So, you know, I can connect with someone in, you know, the opposite side of the country who I've never met before. But at the same time, you know, you've got both sides of it. And a lot of this has to do with just they're trying to keep us on their platform. And they don't do it for the sake of evil. It just ends up having a negative impact in a lot of ways on a lot of people.
Well, I think a point you mentioned, Shelley, is very interesting, that the negative emotions are just so much more powerful. And it's very easy to fall into those kind of patterns. So I think it's important that, like, we all are kind of aware of that and, like, actively try to not respond with that kind of just, you know, visceral anger to things. Because that's the fundamental part of communism, was that, like, the history is driven by struggle. You know, we see what happens to a society when everything is reduced to different factions struggling against each other.
One of my favorite podcasts that I've listened to in the past year has been called Conversations with People Who Hate Me. Mm-hmm. And it's done by this guy, Dylan Maron. And he basically, because he's done other podcasts and, you know, he's talked about political issues and people have, you know, left comments like calling him like all kinds of names and things like that. And he actually called up some of these people and talked to them. And that's the basis of this podcast. And it's interesting because you really hear how much harder it is to hate somebody when you're actually having a conversation with them as opposed to just typing angrily, you know, on your keyboard.
Yeah, that is the risk of the internet, that there is that divide between you and, like, another person, so you're just getting,
like, it doesn't seem real. Like, you know, people leave sometimes not great comments for us on our videos because it just doesn't feel like it's you're doing it to a person, right?
Yeah. Well, humans are very social creatures, and, like, humans are designed to interact face-to-face with other people. Like, you notice people's emotional states through, you know, their gestures and facial expressions, and you remove that, you just might as well be talking to a wall. And you don't really realize that you are still impacting another person with the things you type.
Affecting.
What did I say?
Well, no, it's just my personal pet peeve about whether impacting is a verb. Impact is a verb.
It's a very impactful way to talk.
I hate that word so much.
I know, Matt does. It's impacting. This asteroid is impacting the planet.
As Calvin of Calvin and Hobbes once said, verbing weirds language.
Hey, we can all Google something now, right? Huh? That's a verb now.
Or Facebook someone.
Facebook somebody.
Yeah, the article I was reading, the interview with this Jaron Lanier guy, one thing he was talking about was that he thinks the problem with social media is that Silicon Valley basically tried to be both socialist and libertarian at the same time, so it doesn't work.
Well, so what does that mean?
He was talking about basically they were trying to be like, oh, yes, we're going to do this. This is a utopian thing we're going to do for the betterment of humankind. We're connecting people. We're making people's lives better, which is
not... And doing it for free.
Well... That's the part that's the libertarian part where he was like, and then also we're running successful businesses. So what he was like, it doesn't work mixing the two because what you're doing is you're actually like really making people's lives much worse. So he was like, you got to pick one. Either you make Facebook a nonprofit organization and, you know, give it to everybody for free. Or, and he's like, this is the one I suggest. We like you go the libertarian route where you just... stop using people as you basically get people to pay for social media
instead of the people being the product that's yes. being sold.
Yeah, you stop selling people to advertisers because there's always that kind of manipulation. And speaking as someone who's worked in the advertising industry for many years, like you stop having that sort of manipulation that you're always having if you're talking about advertising, so people become the customers.
It's interesting. This is the same thing that happened with communism. There's the sense of we're going to create this utopian society, and the end result is a society where people are not people anymore. They're just commodity that get used and chewed and spit out. So I think the lesson is if somebody is saying they have the answer to a perfect utopian society,
run in the other direction.
Well, I was going to say ignore them and listen to me because I probably have the right idea.
Everybody thinks they have the right idea.
But I know I have the right idea. So 200 years, was Karl Marx right?
Well, according to CCTV, Karl Marx was definitely right. The China Central Television has started it was a 5-part quiz show series called Marx.
That sounds
fun. Yeah, right?
Do you win prizes?
Well, actually, I don't know what you win because I couldn't sit all the way through
it. That would miss the point.
Yes, that's true. You win participation. It actually was directed.
Everyone is an equal loser.
Now that's the truth of communism.
Well, that doesn't go so well on, the recruitment posters.
That Matt saw at the May Day celebration.
But there was something, what it is, Marx was right, is targeted at middle school and high school students. And it's focused on, Marx's works, and you have to answer quiz questions on Marx. And it's think of where in the world is Carmen Sandiego, that, game show that was on PBS when we were kids.
It was a great show. Great show. Had nothing to do with communism.
No. But just think about doing a peppy quiz show for kids, but about Marxism and Karl Marx. And I tried to watch some of it, but it's kind of mind-numbing because it's the kind of things that the kids have to learn in school in their Marxism classes. So it's kind of
Marxism classes,
about what is Marx saying in Das Kapital about capitalism. And the one I watched was about that. So they started off with talking about how the failure of Lehman Brothers in 2008 showed that, that capitalism is a failure. And then they had asked the kids about, what Marx says about capitalism. And it was obviously the kids in the audience were, rehearsed canned answers.
Okay.
And then they ended the show with a great pop song that was about how one of my favorite lines in the pop song was about how Karl Marx's eyes shine brighter than the stars in the night sky.
Whoa.
It was intense.
So they're definitely fanboying about Karl Marx for his birthday.
I mean, when Xi Jinping kind of sets the direction,
everyone follows.
Yeah.
But so fundamentally, was Marx right? What about that?
I mean, if you do a scientific experiment and it fails and then you redo it and then you redo it, how many times does a scientific experiment have to fail before you call it a failure?
Well, maybe they just weren't doing the experiment right, Matt.
Yeah, so communism has failed in 40 countries. So how many, at what point do you look at it and say, no matter what you think of Karl Marx, there's no situation, there's no country in which it has worked.
Actually, it worked in North Korea, which is a much better place than the United States of America.
According to that woman I spoke with, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although North Korea is interesting because it's technically not...
It's technically not communism.
Well, this happens in every communist country. It becomes something that's technically not communism.
Right. Well, in China, it's communism or it's socialism with Chinese characteristics, not communism. Technically, right? Except, obviously, they say their roots are with Karl Marx because they have his picture on the wall.
My question is, what happened to Engels?
Everyone kind of forgets about him.
I prefer rounded corners.
Oh my God.
we don't have the sound effects installed yet. Sorry, Matt. But yeah, I mean, it is the problem when your system has as a fundamental principle the abolition of private property. And to achieve that, you must violently seize that property from other people because obviously they're not going to want to give up their stuff. So it's a system based around the idea of a violent mob seizing power. And surely that will result in a utopia. And with that, let's all give a big collective happy birthday to Karl Marx. What do you think? Was he right? Leave your comments below. Thanks for listening to China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda. Thank you.
We'll see you next time.